Okay, we are recording. Just a heads up to everyone listening, I am without a microphone for the first time. I don't exactly know how my audio quality is going to be, but hopefully it's good. So, with that being said.
Yeah, we're gonna roll with it. And as y'all know, you're listening to Aloud right now, a podcast hosted by Brendan Murtha and myself, Jessica Jones. And Brendan, you were just complimenting these beautiful Monstera plants that I have on my desk. They're actually gifted to me by a friend. And it's funny, but the same friend who gave me these Monstera plants told me something interesting a couple years back now that people are so, we love houseplants so much right now because in some ways it's like a status symbol or trying to get back to nature, but like that ability to get back to nature, to spend all this money on houseplants, especially as we know like how much they've been commodified, right? It kind of says a little something about who you are that you have the luxury of having houseplants. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd ask you, when you think of someone who is really into houseplants and attends to houseplants, is there kind of like a class association?
That's an interesting question, and I would say there's definitely a level of comfort among the people I know who have a lot of houseplants. And that's not to say that they're not like, working hard. Many of them are working like very hard, but it's not like three jobs hard. You know what I'm
Right,
saying?
yeah. No, I don't know. I feel like I do think there's a oftentimes in people's love for houseplants. There is a slightly kind of like frivolous aspect to it. I don't deny that like people, can take great care of their houseplants. And for some people it truly is like a experience of like nurturing and fostering a, kind of like quasi-ecological community within the confines of the home. Totally am sympathetic to that. But I also do feel like there's an interesting commodification of a living thing that occurs during a houseplant transaction. And I don't know, the few times I've gone to greenhouses or just like various different nurseries in order to buy plants, whether for my house or for others, I'm always struck with kind of like the spectacle of it. And there's something, especially as we talk more about plant consciousness and kind of the roles that plants occupy in kind of this great scheme of things, the fact that that doesn't really seem to be questioned. There's still like it's still custom to like give a plant as a gift to someone without even there being like a an assurance that they will take care of it. I don't know. There's I'm glad that you have brought up some of the interesting kind of like undertones to houseplant culture that you could the dark underbelly you could say.
The dark underbelly. So
Deconstructing the house plant.
I don't know if our mutual friend would want their name said, but D?
Yes.
D was one of the first people who bought up something to me. Like, I don't give houseplants because it makes me so sad. Like, people just let them die. They don't take
Yeah,
care of them.
right.
And that made me really think, like, man, I never really considered that, right? I just think, oh, the plant's dead. Like, dang, it sucks. But I mean, what is that plant experiencing? And is that something worth taking into consideration when we give plants to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a weird way, my concern there is less for the actual experience of the plant. I think there's, and this is unfortunate, but I think like oftentimes these plants, grown in greenhouses, grown in like storefronts, like they're, it's kind of subjective experience, whatever that may be, feels kind of particularly off limits to me. I don't want to make any claims to it, but at the same time, what I do feel like I'm qualified to make a claim to is a kind of puzzling cultural sphere in which again, the transaction of houseplants exists. Like, it's houseplants on one level, right? But at the same time, does it really matter what the organism is? The fact that you are able to give and kind of swap these individual organisms, again, without necessarily a concern for the longevity, their longevity or their well-being, but rather it just as like a kind of, yeah, a transactional thing. Like that, I think is where the brunt of my concern lies. Because obviously it's a concern that would sound quite similar if we were, peddling in a tradition of giving people a cat or a dog as a gift. Obviously, we take that to be a much greater commitment that we would never just kind of like pass on a whim. So there is a generalized lack of a care or concern for what happens to a plant after you kind of give it to someone as a gift, certainly. And I think Dee is very right to identify that as indicative of kind of like some broader social malaise, at least as it relates to our relation with plants. Yeah.
Yeah. As you say that, it makes me think too, like how much energy goes into getting the plants to the person. The plants being grown, the plants being fertilized, even who knows, right? Like, where is this knowledge even coming from of these plants? Is this something that was like indigenous knowledge that people are just like profiting off of? It's hurting them, right? Because there's so much energy that goes into anything. Whenever you have transportation, whenever you have growing any kind of plant, right? And so I feel like with that, I consider the plant subjective condition, but then now I also start to think about just the waste that's involved in creating a plant that is going to die immediately, that nobody's even taking care of, right? Yeah. And you can really go down a rabbit hole with that because there's so many things that we consume. And I'm especially thinking about that moving into this house, right? I don't have any real furniture to my name. I've had to purchase so many desks and tables and chairs. And I'm looking at these boxes. The styrofoam itself is wrapped in plastic. And I'm just thinking, what am I supposed to do with this? I mean, I can recycle, right? But isn't there a better way?
Yeah. No, I totally hear that. Again, we have now gone through similar kind of scenarios where I recently moved into a new house. I've settled in here, but as I've settled in here, right, and it's five of us, all college aged, living in the same place. And I am just blown away and frankly somewhat horrified by just like the sheer amount of waste that we produce in a way that it's like not even, I think all things considered, while we certainly, you know, are consistently trying to cut back on things, there is a certain like inevitable amount of waste you just produce throughout the day. That is, when you kind of look at its magnitude and think about, you know, the kind of the aggregate effect of all of this waste piling up, is really remarkable. And it situates you and your personal responsibility in a very kind of strange sphere. Like, I mean, just for instance, like washing dishes today and the sheer amount of water that goes in to clean a dish and the sheer number of dishes that we produce after eating, just like the sheer amount of food that has to, you know, go in to keep our house healthy and happy. And again, as we've kind of talked about in previous episodes, thinking about all the ways in which the food that we consume implicates us in these broader networks of trade and transport and power dynamics and people's lives being deeply implicated, not only human lives and non-human lives being deeply implicated in this kind of web and community we're spinning for ourselves. It really is like sobering. And to go into your point earlier about houseplants, like, it is strange. I definitely am a proponent of like gardening culture, which we've also talked about before. And I think, you know, there is a similar kind of deal where it's like, okay, you can give someone a cucumber plant for them to plant in their backyard or something. And that to me seems, well, I guess some of the kind of like ethical quandaries are still there. That does seem a little more responsible to me than giving someone a house plant. Partly, I think, because even if that plant doesn't like make it, if you give someone a garden gift and they plant it and like they're not really a good steward and it dies, it doesn't make it, etc., at least then, like, in its decay, in its decomposition, like, it's kind of giving back. Its waste is being funneled back into a system that other organism can kind of benefit from, where like if a houseplant dies and you, like, I don't know, throw it in the trash or whatever, like, kind of God knows where that ends up. There's really a sense that we only produce and there's not a kind of reciprocal exchange of giving back, and the, you know, mere things like composting and recycling, obviously, while good steps in the right direction, really often feel like they don't even begin to cut it. I don't know how you feel about that.
I feel like we are in so deep that at times it feels like we're over our heads with everything that's going on, just socially, politically, environmentally, and all the intersections of those things, right? The way they just seem to kind of draw from the same root, but do they draw from the same root? Because I was talking with somebody about this the other day. We were thinking like, yeah, you know, it's capitalism. That's it. That's the problem, you know, and that's why all these things are happening the way they're happening. But is it just human nature? And if I were to say that it's human nature, I mean, what does that imply, right? That we can't do or be better because we're just biologically determined to be this way?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I know we've brought up before. Any kind of discussion of human nature, I think, needs to be approached incredibly cautiously, especially because oftentimes people use kind of like the specter of human nature or use the rationale of human nature to kind of explain away our current, our contemporary scenario, which in like the long kind of schema of things in human history is quite distinct, right? If we know that there are kind of nature cultures that have existed on the face of this planet, whether it be in indigenous ways of living or otherwise, that have done a much better job of kind of negotiating this reciprocity, then you can't make the claim that our divergence from that falls in line with human nature, right? Like every single way of living that has ever arisen on the face of this earth is downstream of human nature to a certain degree. And therefore, if you're going to make the claim that human nature condemns us to, you know, whatever fate, XYZ, I feel like it requires at least an intimate knowledge of all the other kind of ways of life that have been successfully or unsuccessfully employed, just to the degree where it's like, yeah, because those are equally implicated in human nature as well. And if they've figured it out, if someone's figured it out, at least better than we can, then that kind of condemnation for all humanity and kind of just one fell swoop really does not hold up under any sort of scrutiny, right?
Yeah, and I really, really like that line you said about like a culture of nature or nature culture that negotiates reciprocity with nature, and just what that would look like sounds amazing. And it also makes me think back to these houseplants, yo. Like these houseplants, both of them that I have are gifts from friends. And it gets a little weird, right? It gets a little clinical and you're like, and this is a reciprocal relationship that we have. They give me plants, I give them love, you know? But I mean, that's how it's presented in anthropology, yeah. When you're learning about these different indigenous cultures, right? And we look at their practices and we put them through this almost like markety type of lens. But I mean, you could say the same thing about these plants that I have. And I mean, I think it is a really special thing to just have friends and to want to share and to want to give. And since we're talking about human nature, I think that's such a large part of who we are as well.
Yeah, certainly.
Or it could be at least.
But I mean, even so, we're again, in this transaction that we're speaking of with you and your friends and giving houseplants as kind of just like an object in that transaction as opposed to a subject in that transaction, like that itself does not seem, I mean, certainly not rooted in human nature to any fundamental degree. If our relationship to plants, I think, is not static, it's not predetermined. I don't know what you think about that, but
if our relationship to plants is, I guess for so long we've always depended on plants, and we still do, right? Like everything that we have at some level comes from the natural world. But even the delineation of a plant versus an animal versus a protist, right? Like we have drawn these lines as to what is a plant, and those, what we've seen as fundamental boundaries are starting to bleed in current Western models, right? I can't speak for how different cultures around the world have viewed plants or what we consider to be plants relative to other forms of life or other parts of their universe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I find that very interesting. I mean, this gets into a million different, it can go a million different ways from this. But one thing I will say, just last night, actually, I was kind of reading and thinking a lot about kind of my relationship to the science, or the kind of the scientific canon's relationship to classification, which is obviously essential. Obviously, as a like birder and naturalist and someone who loves looking at living things and keeping notes and lists of living things that I've observed, I am like heavily indebted to a system of classification that kind of works, right? I like to be able to attach names to things, etc. But of course, it does kind of follow, and if you look at the kind of the tradition and the history of the way in which classification has been employed, the classification is creating kind of structures and hierarchies, even if you talk about just like basic phylogeny, is the connection of things, placing this discrete box in this place and this discrete box in this place. Similarity and difference is kind of created in that sense. It's a construction. How my kind of love for that system of classification implicates me in all the kind of horrific, horrors that that system has kind of left imprinted on the world. I mean, because the same logic of classification that was often used to kind of delineate one species from another and one genus, family, order, etc., all up this kind of great tree, this great web of life. Those distinctions, of course, were able to be then employed within. Once you kind of begin classifying, it's very hard to stop. There is that kind of ethos, that logic of divvying things up into smaller and smaller subsets and attaching a name to each, which eventually gets to this point where like there needs to be a kind of classified hierarchy, and the logic of that hierarchy is like self-perpetuating and requires further distinction in order to really operate. And this is a like super kind of large, heavy topic to wade into, but as I've again been keeping my bird list, et cetera, I can't help but be aware of it, right?
Have you ever heard of Adam Neely?
Adam Neely?
Yeah, he's the YouTuber who does the music theory stuff.
No, I have not heard of Adam Neely.
Okay, so he, first of all, started doing a lot of music theory videos that are pretty straightforward, like this is this kind of mode and these are scales, but he got pretty advanced because he does a lot of, I think, jazz and he plays bass. But anyways, recently he started to talk about a lot more of the social side of music, and especially he's a white guy, but you know, talking about the contributions and like creation of jazz, like through Black people and all kinds of different really cool, like social commentary that he connects with music and that he thinks is, he presents as, you know, fundamental to music. One of his more recent videos was talking about music theory in the way we are taught it as white supremacist. And his argument was, listen, when we start talking about music theory, we talk about this, like all this history, all this stuff that like white guys were doing in the 18th century. And like, we act like that's the only relevant thing. And he was saying, wouldn't it be so much more intuitive and better to understand if we looked at how rhythm and pitch and scales emerged throughout different cultures? Wouldn't that give us a better understanding of each other? And he had, it was a really interesting video. I was convinced. And thinking about what you're saying now, right? And tracing back this idea of like classification, the way we classify animals, like, you know, when you're in science, you learn the history of science and they show you how Aristotle did it and yada yada, walking through these white guys who did their stuff. And then there's a little bit of ladies in there too, once we get, you know, more than 19th century. And then, you know, finally it's like Neil deGrasse Tyson and now we're great. But how cool would it be if we looked at other systems of knowledge, like right from the get, when we're looking, well, this is how, you know, Western society classified life, but look at how they did it over here. Like, I feel like that could just have so much potential to open our minds, because it's not like they came up with this stuff out of nowhere, you know, like it served a purpose. It fulfilled a role in helping them interact with the world.
Yeah. Well, I think that's actually very interesting. The fact that you brought music theory is excellent, and it's relatedness to this, because it's music theory has always been kind of a subject that's I've been curious about. I actually have, despite being a musician, I have very little knowledge in music theory, which is maybe a regret of mine. But it does also, there's also kind of like a headstrong, kind of just like, I don't know, defiance to it. Because to me, music theory has always seemed, as you kind of brought up, to be this like white man's, like science's way of reclaiming its kind of power over music and over musicians, to the degree where it's like, oh, if we standardize like kind of the science or the mathematics of music, it then firmly inserts music into this kind of cultural tradition of like, oh, the academics and the people who expertise in their field, right, which is obviously mediated and kind of supported by all sorts of different structures of privilege and limited access, etc., like they can now define what music is and also can define what it means to be a good musician, right? Like, obviously, whether or not we take it to be true, right? Like the relation, I don't know, like circle of fifths and all that stuff. Like, yes, obviously it exists. These are words that we have, and there's maybe a useful way of viewing music. But all too often, I feel like those who kind of have a deep knowledge of music theory, like, yes, it can make you a better musician, but I oftentimes feel like the best musicians are those who don't have kind of the faintest idea of kind of that legacy. And I guess one of the reasons that is because music to me, and maybe this is going to be off kilter, but music to me has always felt like the subversion of a kind of mind body dichotomy that I think is very important in kind of understanding. It's like definitely running through kind of most of the classificatory systems that I've already kind of laid out, right? Like one of the ways in which colonialism, certainly, but really all kind of traditions of Western supremacy in whatever form that may take, the kind of way they rationalize that is through your kind of like great chain of being, right? So brain on top, body on beneath, or pure brain being opposed to pure body, pure brain being closer to God, pure body being closer to just like pure matter or soil, etc. And in the rungs of this ladder that connects the two, that is where all hierarchy is kind of based, and all classifications take objects and fit them in this hierarchy, whereas those who are closer to mind have any kind of implicit and natural rationalization of the ways in which they can kind of control or make decisions for the body, because that's the way we understand things work. Mind controls the body, the mind is at the center of rational thinking, etc. The body is a machine to kind of be controlled and to be dominated by the mind. And the way in which this, I think, relates to music is super interesting, because music seems to be, you know, it operates on a cerebral level, you could say, but also, right, like there's in rhythm, in tempo, etc. Like your body is heavily implicated. They kind of become indistinguishable from one another. And it has always seemed that music is like a body's kind of way of asserting its equal footing with the mind. I don't want to say dominance. I think that is how unfortunate to use the language of this hierarchy that I've just been condemning. And music theory seems all too often to try to submit music and structure music through the kind of lenses of the lens of this hierarchy that I've just been talking about. Whereas to me, great music is inherently kind of bottom up. And maybe that's my own romantic reading of it, but yeah.
Even as you talk about rhythm in music, like I find myself rocking and just like moving my body to like some imagined rhythm in my mind. And there's something so that feels so natural and beautiful to it. And as someone, I am by no means an expert in music theory. It's definitely like a lot of things where once you start learning a little bit, you're like, oh gosh, this is expansive. But I have dedicated a considerable amount of time to learning different aspects of music theory. And recently, I've been focusing a lot more on technique. Mm-hmm. And I have seen improvement with both. Because I think with music theory, at least the way I tend to approach it, like I try not to let it box me, right? Mm-hmm. Like I feel like it kind of, how do I even say this? I'm looking at my guitar right now and all the frets and the strings. I have, oh my gosh. So I have a guitar, I have my acoustic and electric, and now I have a bass.
Cool.
I know, I'm really excited to learn it. But anyways, what was I even saying? Yeah, I don't know. As far as music theory goes and then like versus just like actually playing the instrument, I feel like they both have their space. But music theory, it reaches a point where like the things that you may cover or learn about when you have almost like, you know, a structure to follow, it eventually becomes just as natural.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, so I kind of see it as like, oh, here are some ideas that I could use, that I could expand upon, mm-hmm. that I could grow with. But yeah, I do know some people who seem to be boxed in by music theory, and I wonder how much of that is just a matter of personality, yeah. more so than the nature of it itself, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, certainly, like I said, like music theory is legitimate. I often, you know, I'm fortunate enough to spend time with good musicians every once in a while. And I also have always had kind of just a propensity for music, grew up in a very musical family, et cetera. And there's certainly
where it's- You're pretty good too.
Well, I appreciate it.
I remember seeing you on the keyboard and you're like, yeah, I don't know. No, you sounded fucking awesome on that.
Well, it was one of those things where like, obviously I feel like, you know, when I listen to music, I do have like this, there's an implicit kind of understanding of like form, right? Just like, I have, you know, some official musical schooling. So like music reads in my head on a more structural level than it may be for like an entirely untrained listener. And I'm certainly aware that like, you know, all that structure that I kind of claim to be tapping into is explainable through music theory. Like it obviously has done an incredible job of providing us kind of framework to understand these things. Yet at the same time, like, I mean, I remember one of the, back when I was taking like drum lessons, for instance, I mean, my drum teacher was very, very adamant. He was like, the only thing that matters when you play music is like whether, like your feel for it. Like you don't have to have any, like technicality helps, right? Yes, having like the technical knowledge helps. Having a theory of or having a knowledge of music theory probably also helps. But ultimately, like there have been musicians who've made it, who the only thing they have kind of going for them is ability. They just like really are able to feel music. Now I'm just like, lay it down in the pocket. Like keep it simple. Keep it. And that, I mean, always rubbed off on me in a very significant way, especially because that seemed to me a like powerful refutation to. Again, the kind of like imposition of Western knowledge into things that have always just seemed to be, I know, again, very kind of like organic and body centric as opposed to otherwise. But I'm also aware that even as I lay out that kind of dynamic, I cannot speak to ethnomusicology in a way where like perhaps many cultures in which distinct music styles are developing independently had kind of like a very distinct and very articulate music theory of their own or music theory equivalent. But music theory as we know it being a very, again,
okay.
Western imposition.
Okay, so music theory as a Western imposition, right? Other people, they have their things going on. Do we consider that to be music theory? Is it something else, you know? Is music theory a value judgment, right? This is music theory versus this is that. So I don't lose myself on this. What I'm trying to say is, if our idea of science has come along specifically as a way to describe these Western, often elite practices, can something that's not developed in a Western system truly be scientific? And is that a bad thing?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question. What do you think?
So I have been wondering this for a while because I was in a conversation, some years ago, where somebody said, we're talking about like philosophies, and they're like, oh yeah, Buddhism is more in, no, they're saying Stoicism and Buddhism are very similar, but Stoicism is more intellectual. And I was like, what are you even talking about? Like, I just felt my eyes roll to the back of my head, Brendan. And I don't know, I just felt like it was such a kind of gross thing to say. And to be fair, I mean, I don't know how the person meant it, but, you know, it's not hot. But it did make me wonder, you know, I looked up the etymology of intellectual, and sure enough, it derives from, like, Greek origins, Greco-Roman origins, just like Stoicism did. And it makes me wonder, you know, if the very words that we're using are coming from this system, specifically, like, you know, their value, we think of them as these value judgments to describe things that were like the elite within the system. Can they ever truly apply to things outside of that system? You know, do we need to know like the Buddhist equivalent of intellectual to define Buddhism? Like, can we expand these words, or are these words inherently narrow just because of their origins?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, and that, I think oftentimes, like, the lack of an equivalent, I don't want to say that, but like, yeah, in the language that we use, right, and kind of, again, being immersed in this like long cultural tradition, is simultaneously a cultural tradition that is heavily implicated in the same kind of like hierarchical, like fundamental hierarchical system that I talked about earlier. And in which case, like, all of our language and like the kind of symbolic elements of our, the words that we use, have to be equally like kind of deconstructed to the point where it's like, how does what, when we think of intellectualism as like a virtue, right, or intellectualism something to be emanated, like, we even if we come to the conclusion that like this is one good thing we can pluck from the canon to kind of take it over to our next whatever utopia we're building, it's also like the very process of deconstruction has to, I think, first occur, which can be, I think, aggravating and tiresome, because just as we realize, again, even like every single word that we use being heavily implicated in these same kind of traditions, and how, like, without even knowing it, the language that we speak is boxing us into a very, like, again, erasing other ways of knowing, per se, because of just the value judgments that we are just implicit among what we associate with these words versus it just being a sound that we're throwing out to the ether. And it has such power. I think that's an essential kind of act of, I don't know, because through deconstruction, there's also an incredible act of creation that goes alongside it. So
100%. It's so, I feel like, just so necessary to take apart these words and what they really say. And I've written a lot about this, mainly like poetry and stuff, because, you know, as a Black person, like, my ancestors didn't speak English.
Yeah.
I have no idea what language they spoke. I guess I have some ideas, right? They might have spoken something like Yoruba or Igbo. But it just makes you wonder, like, how much of that experience is gone, can't be expressed, can't even be touched, because we're speaking another language, and not just another language, you know, but the language that was used to freaking divide half the world and chew it up, right? Like, even the very word Lord, we pray to a Lord, and I know you and I talked about this on the phone, and I don't remember if we recorded this. Did we, about the Lord
thing? I don't think we did, no.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I was looking at the word Lord, and Lord is a contraction for some random old English word that means guardian of the loaves. Loaves, like loaves of bread. This also ties into reciprocity, because the word for servant was a word that basically translated into bread eater, right? Yeah. So on the surface, it kind of seems like, oh, you know, one person, they guard the loaves, and then you work for them, you're the, and then the bread eater is the one who works for them. I don't know, what do you make of that? I feel like, well, there's so much on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, well, so one of the things we're certainly getting into here is kind of just like topics of like linguistic relativism, which I know is contentious. Basically, just the idea that like the language you speak mediates human subjectivity to such a degree that like subjectivity itself is constructed downstream of the language that we use. Like, so, like, for instance, like someone like that, there's surface level examples, such as like, okay, English is not really a gendered language, right? Whereas like Spanish is a gendered language. And is it that for a native Spanish speaker, someone who grew up speaking Spanish, versus someone who grew up speaking English, that kind of the gender nature of language actually imparts upon the world differing kind of qualities of perception? Like if you perceive the world through the kind of the sieve of gendered language, are objects actually almost like subconsciously gendered to you? And what does that mean in the way you interact with them versus in a non-gendered language, vice versa? Of course, that's a kind of surface level example with not a ton of, at least as far as I can tell, powerful or significant implications. But of course you get down to it on a deeper level. And this is one thing that one of my favorite books, I highly recommend to anyone, Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. Yeah, she talks about several different indigenous languages from North American continent, and just how in a lot of these kind of languages, they're what you would consider a very verb-heavy language as opposed to a very noun-heavy language. English and most Romance languages being a very noun-heavy language. And the idea that in a language that has more verbs, like certain things that we would classify as a noun, which is again static, kind of boxed in, person, place, or thing, being kind of an object that you can hold. When your language is kind of verb-heavy and some of those same phenomenon get described in a verb, which gives it a kind of subjective movement, that has really heavy implication for the way in which you kind of see, again, the subjectivity of like the non-human other, and not only subjectivity, but also just like a generalized sense of movement versus like static, discrete quanta. And that to me seems to be an example of like linguistic relativism's more, I think, consequential conclusion. Which is that, like, for instance, English or any romance language that was kind of spread to supplant indigenous ways of speaking and knowing, supplanting verbs for noun, kind of boxes in, takes things that were once alive and moving and kind of renders them sterile and you can say two-dimensional in a sense. In which case, yeah, like we have an obligation, I think, to understand how, like, even through some of the most basic tenets of the English language, like the distinction between a verb and a noun, like what kind of qualities does that descriptor, again, these are not like implicit. If you recognize that languages around the world have different kind of ways of dealing with these this categorization, language does really then become, it has to be seen as a tool and kind of a weapon of power. And that very much gets at what you were just talking about, but kind of expanding on just like the significance and the necessity of really taking language as kind of an object in itself, right?
Yeah, and so with all of that, it makes me think, you know, language is not neutral.
No, certainly not.
There's nothing, you know, nothing, no kind of language you can use is neutral. But I suppose the manners then, right, being aware of the language you're using, the power that it holds and what you can do with that.
Yeah.
Right? Because even silence is powerful. You know, silence is very powerful. Like a whatever, you know, oh, whatever, you know, in the right circumstance, I mean, that can devastate, you know, or totally empower, even though it's seemingly a non-committal word. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's just such a beauty in that. Such a beauty in that.
I guess I'll ask you, going off what I was just kind of saying about linguistic relativism, right? So you, if you take it on face value, or you take it as kind of an assumption that like all human beings have a similar, we'll stay kind of anthropocentric here, but all human beings have this kind of like similar essence at their core, right? And language is kind of this mediating screen through which the language you have, like it'll never get it exactly what you mean, right? There's always that disconnect in language, but it's like to the best of your ability, you are able to take that internal essence, kind of project it into the world around you. So that seems to be a non-relative quote, where it's like we all start at the same essence. The language we just use like acts as a different kind of screen to interacting with the real world. But my question is, do you think that that's oversimplified to the degree where the language that you put out in the world the way in which like you have a discrete number of tools in which to kind of interpret your internal feelings and interpret the way they interact with the external world that actually then modifies as a process of using language, the internal essence itself. That was maybe a convoluted question.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Okay, no.
I had it, but then I was like, what?
Basically, okay. Do you think the language that you use, the language that you've grown up using, do you think it fundamentally alters the human that you are or your sense of self? Or does it just act as a mediator and ultimately we are all, you know, we all are experiencing things basically the same way?
Oh, I mean, yes to both. Because I think we are definitely more similar than we are different, right? So maybe that's taking a step down from what you said. We basically experience things the same. Or maybe it's not even taking a step down, but just elaborating, right? Like, yeah, basically, I think we do experience things the same, right? Like we feel happy, hungry, sad, angry, all these pretty core emotions in the ways that they emerge. And I also think that the way I see the world largely is connected with language. And, you know, of course, there's the very words that I use and we can break them down linguistically, but it's also the knowledge. Like I said, the knowledge that this isn't a language that my ancestors spoke. And this yearning to have a different understanding and feeling isolated from that. Like, I think that's definitely defining in a sense of character and like what I want, like what I strive for, right?
Yeah.
Which is largely like defining like what does it mean to be Jess? What does it mean to be Jess, man? What does it mean to be a human on this earth? And to even have these kinds of questions. I mean, you know, everything kind of goes through language and is changed because of it. Language is so important. When you look at, you know, groups of people who they can't even speak their language in the government, right? Like at the state or at a federal level, they can't go into some kind of conference and start talking in their language. They have to speak Spanish or they have to speak Brazilian or they have to speak English, right? Like people can't speak their traditional tribal cultural languages. I mean, that's pretty impactful in how somebody's going to live their life.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I agree with that 110%.
Yeah, and even the Cornish people. I was learning about this the other day. Actually, the Welsh people. I'm not sure what the Cornish people are doing.
Cornish is alive and well. It's like kicking or having a resurgence, which is exciting. But
good on them. No, yeah, I was just saying, like, I was learning about these people who were trying to revive the Welsh language, and, like, they were really proud and excited about it. And that's another thing. Oh, my gosh. And this could open up a whole thing. But, like, I want to know, like, where did this idea of the West come from and who did the West have to conquer to get there? And like, who of those people who we now consider the West are actually just like assimilated losers? And when I say losers, I mean the sense of like, you know, the ones who don't write history.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an excellent question. And where to even begin? I mean, I think that you can kind of trace out one of the interesting things about language, I think, is that especially like language is kind of a marker of the winners, right? Mm. Like what languages predominate, like if you basically create kind of a linguistic phylogeny, that's the second time I've used that word this episode, looking at the ways in which languages kind of connect and grow off of one another, I think tracing that back, you know, how many speakers each language has, et cetera, tracing that back through history, overlaying it onto historical timelines, it kind of becomes, I think, a proxy for like conflict. in a sense, which is maybe an unfortunate and derivative reading of language, but certainly where it's like, okay, when languages have died out, like we can kind of make an assumption, or let's say a language was pretty much just enveloped into something new, right? Or the kind of the behemoth, the Leviathan of kind of the central language that was working its way through an area at the time, drawing smaller or drawing pieces from all the kind of languages that were informing it in kind of a pigeon. But at the same time, those languages were being sidelined as a result. There's kind of this cruel act of assimilation, as you referred to earlier, and like all the kind of the losers being incorporated into the Western canon, just as English, right, is obviously a language that has drawn on immense influences from across the European continent and the world, including languages certainly that no longer really exist, and that kind of meddled and mixed together to form what we now consider the English language, which is obviously still evolving. Like the contours of power and the contours of hierarchy can be seen within the way languages change. And I think English's ascendance to kind of become, we are certainly, I think, on the verge of an unprecedented area of global history where more so than ever before, there has been kind of a universal tongue, for better or for worse. Like English is really kind of working its way to be the kind of like common language of the world. And that's contested in certain areas, but I think right now its role as that player is kind of undeniable. In which case where it's like, wow, what does that mean? If English is kind of become the first like unifying language in that sense, what does that kind of speak to about the unprecedented nature of like and power in the modern world, and kind of like this quasi neo-imperialism that again seems like we are far removed from the kind of annals of history and the warring of languages, the warring of cultures, etc. But obviously, as we're seeing, even as we look at something like the spread of English around the world, like this conflict and this kind of story is now, well, it may be a little bit obfuscated, a little bit obscured behind these kind of like happy-go-lucky ideas, like, oh, like English, finally a unifying language, like we will all revel in our shared humanity, and like this is the end-all be-all. It's like that seems a little tone-deaf when we like, I don't know. Absolutely, yeah, language is power, and we need to be critical of that.
Language is power. Oh God, you just said so many good things. I don't even know where to start. Okay, but I'm gonna start with this. Language is power. The evolution of language is power. And the evolution of language is threatening. And when people use language in a way that's different from how other people are using language,
yes, yeah,
they don't know what to do with themselves. You know, you can think about like, you know, obviously like teens and slang or whatever. But even when I think about AAVE, Ebonics, and even, you know, perhaps like different pidgin languages or mixed languages like Spanglish or whatever, you know, people get weirded out when people use English in a way that denotes other things, right? Like if I use a word and you use this word to mean that, and I use a word to mean this, that is threatening to that person, or at least that's the way it seems. And I guess it's because they have power in having the shared understanding, right? Mm-hmm. But like if I have the understanding that other people are starting to understand, you know, that takes something.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I find it kind of on that note, I find the term grammar Nazi to be really interesting. Mm. A term that you don't really hear all that much anymore. I feel like it's kind of antiquated, but I feel like I used to hear that term all the time, like in school and stuff like that. It'd be like, oh, that teacher, she's a grammar Nazi, which is such a, I think, an interesting on face value. It's like, wow, like how is that ever used? But at the same time, it does speak to actually something really interesting, because grammar in itself, like someone who is like really rigid in their enforcement of grammar, like these very prescriptive ways in which like there is a correct way to speak a language, as kind of just like this almost fascist like authoritarian control over the ways in which people communicate themselves, which seems actually more in line with kind of like a Nazi product, just on face value. You don't even need to like use the word Nazi as a descriptor in this case. Like, so it was just, it was an interesting kind of just like reflection or manifestation of kind of like the interesting ways in which the immense power of language, and it would bubble up through like funny little terms like haha grammar Nazi, where it's like, no, like we're getting at something really, really significant here. Like we're kind of like laughing off like the serious power of language to like make and unmake lives and enforce and disrupt and deconstruct power. And yeah, I look back on all those times where we were just like, you know, wandering through the hallways of middle school and throwing around terms like grammar Nazi, completely divorced or completely just completely naive to the actual implications of what like our everyday terms we're getting at in terms of their implications on our lives and others.
And think about what other words we were throwing around and people older than us were throwing around.
Oh yeah.
That have completely, that we do not see those words the way that some might have seen them then. And part of that maybe is because people who are hurt by those words now have more of a voice or have more power. Right? Because if there's something you say and all of a sudden you can't say this thing, it's a bad thing that takes away something from you.
It does, yeah. I mean, I think when words fall out of kind of circulation, there's always a power dynamic at play.
Even using the word takeaway, I feel funny about that, right? It's like, is it really taking away from somebody? Is it adding to society? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I have conflicting feelings about this. Well, maybe wait, it's some contentious waters here. Like, for instance, I often feel that the policing of language, like the policing, let's say for like microaggressions, right? So there are words that we have recently kind of designated as off limits, right? Within the English language.
Recently.
I mean, I don't want to.
You give me some like, don't even say the word, but just like.
Okay, no. I'll what you're talking about. For instance, I'll say the word like retard, okay?
Oh, yeah.
This is like a relatively new development. And I think ultimately through the act of us kind of deconstructing language and deconstructing the power dynamics behind language, removing words from our lexicon when we deem them to be inappropriate is like a really important, like it's an important part of any language's development. So like I have made a real strong, push to remove that word from my vocabulary entirely. But I'm also aware of in the same way how oftentimes people can then weaponize, like there are people, like many kids that I've known growing up in kind of just like working class families, etc., who often just like had a slightly different type of humor, etc., and using that sort of word was something that was very normal for them, and it maybe didn't take on a nefarious element that like certain people prescribe to it. And now in this kind of policing of language by generally upper class people towards working class language, like oftentimes I think when like I just in you know internet discourse, etc., like it's always, it seems like some wealthy East Coast liberal being like, you know, you've used X word, or like you and your friends at home use X word, and that word like is an indication that you are blah 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 blah. Something that they have kind of assigned to you. And obviously this sounds like just like the reactionary whining of anyone who's like why can't things just stay the way they are? But at the same time, I do think we have to be critical of that same, that the way in which the power dynamics of language replicate themselves as we, like, whose language are we policing? And if you take away the language entirely and you just look at the players in that, if you just look at who is critiquing who, what does it speak about, like, wanting to have control over language and what control over language means in the long term? Like, if you take away what the people on Facebook are even bickering about, even though we would generally agree that, like, yes, remove the R word, for instance, from circulation, and it's a bunch of just like, you know, again, like working class people from like the American heartland arguing with, you know, people on the coast with a lot of money about like what their language should be. That seems really insidious to me. Even if we had agree on principle with the logic of it, or like what word is being erased, like we have to be consistently critical of these kind of dynamics.
Yeah, we do. But you know, also, and it didn't really click for me either till you mentioned, like, you know, working class heartland of America. These are the same folks, dude, who are out there voting for you know who.
Oh yeah, I know.
You know, there's just so many different. There's so many different elements going on. Because I also wonder too, like, some of the folks I know who are all up into intersectionalism and whatever, a lot of these people are working class.
Yeah.
But it can be used by your typical like upper class liberal against the working class, for sure. Like that policing of language. But I see it a lot within not that group.
Yeah, certainly. But I get,
maybe it's just a matter of where I'm from. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think, obviously, I don't want to paint anything as just like these generalizations. But I think oftentimes also like, people will dig in their heels over a word that they otherwise wouldn't dig in their heels over, because it feels like this kind of like cultural imposition, because like everyone deep down knows that control of language is really significant. And so when they feel like their language is being kind of like meddled with by some outside force, it stokes this just like deep kind of like frantic resistance, again, kind of detached from what the word even is. And obviously this is really complicated and you can wade into a lot of like contentious territory, but again, I think any discussion of language though has to, I think, consider again the ways in which, if language is a contour of power, these struggles are power struggles among other things and need to be understood as such.
This is like that George Carlin. Okay, if George Carlin was now with seven words he can't say on a podcast, I guess I shouldn't ask you to say those seven words because we can't post this.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But I feel like the words have changed, haven't they? I mean, George Carlin's words, whatever, you know, like nobody really cares anymore. Did people care that deeply back then about the F word? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine, right? Because it's like, that doesn't really mean anything. And I feel like that's kind of the point. And when I say the F word, I do mean the F-U-C-K word.
Oh, okay. That's actually not the word I was thinking of. Interesting.
The other F word is not great.
No, it's not. Yeah.
It's not great. But it was a word people said. Not very long ago. I was listening to Gil Scott-Heron, of all people, and I like this artist. I've had, you know, he's somebody who, like, I just always respected. Oh my gosh, I listened to a song by him that was so bad that I thought that he was obviously going to subvert what he was saying. I was like, there's no way that he's actually saying what he's saying. Like, I thought he was going to be like, and that's what I'd say, I was a jerk. Like, it was so bad. And it just got worse and worse. And I was like, what the? And like, it just makes me think, you can't tell me that people thought this was okay. Did people really think it was so bad? I need to send it to you.
Yep. Okay. Please do. I will. I have been warned. I think these are, yeah, exactly. It's hard to put yourself in these shoes. But like, I feel like you have to at least try. Like, it's so, even, I don't know. I mean, that's obviously a privileged thing to say.
Fuck. I have mixed feelings towards it. I really do. Because on one hand, like, I want to understand. I want to be able to like interact with people and not feel like, you know, I can't even talk to you because you said this thing and maybe you grew up with it and maybe da da da. But like, I just can't look at you, you know.
Yeah,
but then like, when we bring up the fact that like some of the, like, these folks are also, it's hard, right? I'm about to generalize. But when you think about the fact that, you know, some of these folks are saying this shit and then they are voting on people and taking political action in a manner which harms the groups that they're referring to through their language, which makes me think, you know, maybe this goes a little deeper than just
certainly
the language you grew up with. But obviously it's case by case, but that's kind of my general
feeling. Well, no, I mean, Yeah, I would totally agree with that, especially because not to deny the significance of the way in which if you refer to someone or some group of people by a word that you were taught growing up and it had a derogatory connotation, even if you aren't really thinking of it, that clearly shapes the way you see the world. Language is incredibly powerful in that sense, just as it is equally powerful that when the way in which language changes, even if it again ostensibly for good reasons, to get rid of language such as that can oftentimes, I think, stir up kind of an unexpected resistance, and that can actually drive home the power of that word. It's very complicated. I think you're right to wade into this with caution, because certainly we must. But yeah, no, I just think about and I've had a bunch of conversations lately with I have some friends from home who still speak in ways that I don't exactly agree with all the time, or not that I just certain words, nothing really nefarious, but just certain little jokes or comments. And I'm always, especially because I have often felt, this is something we've talked about before, I kind of have a foot in two different worlds right now. I have a foot in home, where a lot of my friends are not at school and are just working retail jobs, very, very working middle class, etc. And I'm also at a relatively elite university right now, with people who are incredibly attuned to language and use it, are aware of its power for better or for worse, and who, because they kind of have that sensibility, would be very quick to look at friends from home and paint them an incredibly dismissive or condescending brush, being this language that you use is indicative of XXX cultural factors, which are we should stamp out, versus at the same time, fundamentally, all the real psychopaths, all the real dangerous people are here at this school and have that obsession with language. And it's mm-hmm. I don't know, it makes me uncomfortable. And I constantly feel every time I make a claim about some word or some thing involving language, I then have to kind of turn around and just kind of consume it alive. Doesn't mean that I can't take objective stands about certain words being bad, but I don't know.
Man, Brendan, if you were to summarize this episode in 7 words, because I really like that theme, what would you say?
God, I have to count out 7 words.
Yeah, sorry.
Plants, words, music. Oh, but 7 words. Yeah, okay. I was thinking syllables for a sec. Plants, words, music are all important signifiers. Woo! This is a liberal arts education.
Completely. Hey, this is all about that interdisciplinary
information
out here on Aloud.
Sometimes I feel like a joke. How can this be real? It's fine. It's fine. Anyway, yeah, we should probably wrap up, unfortunately. A pleasure as always.
Truly.
Okay. Guys, this has been Aloud. We are signing off from this, again, very scattered but important episode. See you guys next time.